Well, let's open up this morning to a brand new book in the Bible, Book of Job. We haven't had a pop quiz in a while. I like to pull those on you every now and then, just make sure you're still awake out there. So, pop quiz this morning. What's the oldest book in the Bible? What would you say, top of your head? Job. Oh, gosh, you guys are good. You've done your homework. Many people would have said Genesis. And Genesis deals with the oldest things in the Bible, the creation of the world, the universe, and everything that's in it. But in terms of what the oldest book in the Bible is, you'd have to say it was probably the book of Job. That's one of the things that makes it such an interesting book. When we look at the book of Job, we see some things that tell us information about where it fell in time in terms of its being written. We see the words for God, the words for Satan. We see information about angels. It tells us that this is a book that comes out of the Jewish tradition of writing. And yet we see nothing about Judaism itself. Nothing about Moses, no mention of the law or the temple or the Jewish people. So that tends to make us date the book before any of those things happen. So let's kind of go back in history now. We've been following the Old Testament. We've been following the history of the nation. We went to the Babylonian captivity and the reestablishment of the nation. Let's throw it in reverse this morning and go way back. Let's go back before the Exodus, before Moses, before there was a Jewish people. And that is most likely the time that this book is talking about. When we look at it, we see that wealth is described not in terms of gold and silver, but in terms of agriculture and livestock. And that again puts it back pre-Moses, probably in the days of Abraham. It seems to be a pretty safe bet to say that the book of Job was written as the ancient great power of Egypt was just getting its start in the world. So this becomes a very ancient book. This was probably written by Moses, most people believe. It's very likely that Moses, as he was living in Midian, after he'd left Egypt and before he was called to go back and lead God's children out, as he was living in Midian, he probably ran into either Job himself or some of Job's descendants who shared that oral history with Moses and kind of gave him the information. There's another reason I think the book is interesting, not just because it's so old, but also because it talks about the subject of pain. And when I talk about pain, I'm not simply talking about physical pain. I'm talking about pain and suffering. I'm talking about the human condition in this world. That's pain that can strike you physically, yes. It can be the pain of surgery or the pain of illness or the pain of injury. But it's other pains as well. It can be emotional pain, the kind of pain that you go through when there's a divorce or a betrayal from a friend. It covers the kind of pain that we go through when the uncertainties rise in our life, intellectual pain, when we don't know what the right answer is, when life brings us circumstances that if we could change them by any means, we would. But we simply can't change the course of affairs in our lives. And we come into doubt and uncertainty. It can even deal with spiritual pain when we're uncertain what God is up to in our lives. Is there anyone in the room today who has not experienced pain in one fashion or another? Anyone at all? I'd like to see your hand if you're here this morning. And typically, any one of us can say that we know what pain is, because pain comes very early. Children cry to get what they want. When they cry, they're expressing discomfort with the world they live in. They're expressing dissatisfaction and, in a certain sense, pain. As we become older, we learn to exchange those cries for words. And some of the first words that we use indicate that we know something's wrong in our lives. A situation will occur, a parent will deal with a child, and the child will respond back, "You don't love me." If you're a parent, you've probably heard that. And that's our way of saying, there's something going on in my life that's unfair, I don't like it, I don't understand it, I don't want it. As we grow up, pain takes more and more forms in our lives. There's the bully at school who just seems to just zero in on us and pick us out. Can't get to school without walking by that jerk. We grow up and there's pain that comes with dating and marriage and divorce. There are injuries, there are illnesses, there are betrayals. There's confusion and uncertainty and doubt. And that's a part of this world. So the book of Job deals with the subject of pain in our lives. Now, we're going to spend about the next 5 weeks studying the book of Job. And I can't promise you a lot of answers. Because in this area, answers are sometimes hard to come by. We'll see that as we go through the text. We'll understand why that is so. But here's what I can promise you. If not answers, understanding. We go through life and we don't always find the answers that we're looking for to the questions that we have. Isn't that true? But sometimes we come to certain understandings about life. And sometimes we come to a point where we have a way of looking at life and we now have some understanding of how things work and how we can meet situations and how we can move through them and be victorious. I can guarantee you we'll have that. So some answers, maybe not all the answers, but some understanding of how things work. We'll also get the privilege of having God pull aside the veil so that we don't see things simply from an earthly perspective, but we get the heavenly viewpoint. And that's going to be very valuable in giving us some of that understanding. So without wasting any more time on introduction, let's get into the book of Job this morning. Let's pick it up in chapter 1, in verse 1. We're going to be looking at a man who was, for the time in which he lived, the greatest man in the world. That's what the Bible calls him. Job chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And so it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did regularly." So as the story opens, we're in an ancient land that we don't know much about, the land of Uz. It's very possible that this is somewhere in the area of old Edom, south and slightly east of Israel. Back in Genesis 36, it lists a man who was listed as a king in those days. His name was Jobab. Some people believe that person, back in Genesis, was this Job. He's described as the greatest man in all the earth. He would have been known to those people as a king of sorts. He was extraordinarily wealthy. Today we'd just say stinking rich, man. When you numbered his herds, if you looked at just one kind of animal, just camels, the herds would number in the thousands of animals. And he had herds of many animals. Again, there's no mention of wealth or gold or silver. You were judged wealthy by the number of animals in your herds. Job was not only rich, but he was blessed with children as well, 10 children. I don't know much about these kids, and the Bible doesn't tell us much. It just seems they had kind of a comfortable, laid-back sort of life. When it describes their lives, it says that, well, every day of the week, one of the sons would host a banquet. And all the family would come over and they would eat and drink. So I guess these kids were kind of like the original party animals. They would just get together and eat and drink and have a great time. Dad was wealthy and they could afford it. Job was not only known as a king in his day, as an extraordinarily wealthy man, he was the priest of his home. And that was something that was done prior to Moses and the giving of the law and the Levitical priesthood. Every man was the priest in his own family. And so Job, at the end of the week, would pray for his children and offer offerings for them, offerings for each child, praying to God that if those children had sinned, that they could be forgiven. The Bible tells us that Job was blameless, upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. Now let's be clear about what that means. Do you know anyone who's upright? Blameless. Absolutely spotless and without sin. Of course not. And Job wasn't that kind of person either. But what they mean is that if you examined his life, you couldn't really find anything to get a handle on. Today, if you talk about politicians or historical figures, often it's commonplace to note that along with their great accomplishments are some great failings in their lives, aren't there? We look at historical figures. We look at people who've led politically or led spiritually. And often we find that there's hand-in-hand with the greatness some failing in them. And it's very common to say, you know, this political leader of the past was a great man. Of course, there was his womanizing, and if we put that aside, though, we look at him, he's just a great man. Or we'll say that this was a very powerful leader. Behind doors, of course, the alcohol flowed a little too freely. But other than that, he was a great man. And it seems like it's always possible to look at great people and say they were great, but they had this problem too. When you looked at Job, you couldn't say that. Of course, he was a man. He was fallen. He was a sinner like the rest of us. But if you looked at his life, you couldn't find a sin and say he was a great man except for this. He was just a great man. Sinner like the rest of us. But God's estimation of Job is that he was upright and blameless. So as we start out, we're looking at a man who's great in a worldly sense. He's also great in a spiritual sense. If there was anybody who really shouldn't have had reason to suffer, it would have been this man, Job. No reason for it that we could see. And yet, watch what's about to happen. You've kind of gotten a view of Job's life on earth. Now God kind of pulls that curtain aside and lets us see with a spiritual vision what's going on in heaven. So right now, the first thing that we get is the heavenly viewpoint of Job's life and what's about to take place. Verse number 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." And then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now, stretch out your hand, and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. As the scene opens in heaven, the sons of God, the angels, are presenting themselves before God's throne. In with them comes a character by the name of Satan. Isn't that interesting? Here's where you don't maybe get answers, but maybe a little understanding. According to newspaper theology, that's the kind that you get in the cartoon section. You know, when you see the little cartoons and Peter's at the, you know, Golden Gates and Satan's down in heaven ruling things. Isn't that where Satan is? Isn't he in hell ruling? Well, according to the book of Revelation, hell isn't open for business yet. And Satan has no desire to be there at all. Satan has access to heaven. One of the last places you'd expect to find that rascal is up before the throne of God. But do you know that the Bible just told us that when the angels of God present themselves before God, Satan came in among them. So where is Satan today? Well, God asked him that question. He said, "Where you been?" And Satan says, "Oh, I've been cruising, man. Cruising the world. Up and down, back and forth, free and roaming, anywhere I wanted to go." And when the angels assembled before God, Satan came among them. So if you're looking for Satan today, there's two places you're likely to find him. You're likely to find him down in this world causing trouble. I don't personally think that Satan has much to do with my life. He's got way bigger fish than me to fry. But he's out there, you can bet. He's probably roaming around Congress and the White House, roaming around the Kremlin, roaming around the various power centers of the world. And you can find him in heaven. Interestingly enough, he comes before God in heaven and accuses this blameless man. Let me take you over to the book of Revelation for just a minute. You kind of get a little picture of Satan's job description, if you like. In the book of Revelation, chapter 12, I'll start at verse number 9, where it says, "The great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth and his angels were cast out with him." So in terms of Satan being cast out of heaven, that's something that's still future. He still has access to heaven. And what does he do when he gets there? Look at verse 10. "And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down.'" And so at a point in future, we'll find that Satan is cast out of heaven, cast down and thrown out, no longer having access. But today, Satan has access to heaven. He comes before God. And when he does, what does he do up there? He accuses you and me. He brings a charge against you. Most of us have areas in our life of some kind of greatness. We're maybe exceptional dads or pretty good at what we do at work, but most of us also have some area of failing in our life, and it's that failing in your life that Satan brings before God, and he constantly, day and night, accuses you before God. There's your prosecuting attorney. There he is, standing before the throne of heaven, telling God how you have failed him and how you've let him down. So Satan comes with the angels of God and accuses Job. God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Now, the word "considered" is sort of interesting because it's a military word. It means, have you walked around your objective? Have you looked at it and thought how you might take it? Have you considered how to make war? So, "Have you considered my servant Job? Have you looked at this man? He's upright and blameless." And Satan says, "I've checked him out. And I'll tell you what I think of him. I think he's good to you because you're good to him. I think Job loves you because you do good things for him. But he doesn't love you. He loves the good things you do. And if you were to turn and let those good things turn from Job's life, then he would curse you to your face." And so Job basically accuses God, Satan accuses Job of not loving God, but loving the good things that God brings. He says, "You've made a hedge around him, around his household, and all that he has on every side." Can you hear the frustration in that? Do you think Satan has considered Job over time? I'd say so. One of the greatest men on earth. This is where Satan would concentrate his attack. And when he considers Job, I bet he's tried to come at him. But now he comes and he makes the complaint and he says, "You put a hedge around this man. I can't touch him. I can't get to him. He is simply blessed because of you." And in that, I find one of the greatest encouragements to my life that I could tell you about. The minute you come to Jesus Christ, the minute you place your faith in him and come to God, as soon as you become a believer and a follower of Jesus, God puts a hedge around your life. It doesn't mean nothing bad ever gets in. Every hedge has a gate. But it does mean that there's a gatekeeper. And it does mean that everything comes into your life goes by God before it gets to you. Nothing comes to you that gets by God. Nothing. And that includes the hurtful things, the painful things in our life. That includes illness. Includes injury. It includes emotional pain, betrayal, abandonment. It includes confusions and doubts, spiritual uncertainties. These things come to us, but they do not come to us without God's approval. So one of the most encouraging things that I find so far, and we're only a short ways into this, is the knowledge that when I came to Jesus Christ, God placed a hedge of protection around my life. And Satan can't simply come into my life at will. It's important to know that about Satan. He's your enemy. He considers you. He has a plan for your destruction. He can't touch you until God gives him the authority to do so. I like knowing that. That means that nothing has come to me in my life that didn't come with God's prior consideration and approval. Listen to this from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Here in verse 13 it says, "No temptation has overtaken you, except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. How many times have we seen something coming into our life, some catastrophe, some unpleasantness, some pain or human suffering, and we thought to ourselves, God, this is too much. This is more than I can carry. You can be assured that it's not. If you're following Jesus Christ, whatever comes into your life is not more than you can bear, because God designed you. God knows your stress-bearing limits. He knows what would break you, and He'll never allow that into your life. But He does for His own reasons. Here's one of the answers we don't get today. For His own reasons, sometimes allow Satan to come in and test us, to prove us, to draw us closer to God, and to strengthen us. But it will not break you. So when the storm comes in your life, when the pain and the suffering begin to strike, you can remind yourself that there is a hedge of protection around you, that God will not allow anything near you that would destroy you. And therefore, what you're experiencing can be borne up under with the help of God. That's the key there. That's the important part, with the help of God. That's the heavenly viewpoint. That's what we see. Job sees none of this at this time. He doesn't know. He's experiencing it from the earthly viewpoint. So now let's take a look at the earthly viewpoint of what happens in Job's life. Verse number 13. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came. Can you imagine being Job at this point? I mean, here you are sitting on top of the heap, so to speak, and one by one these servants are coming in. Before the first one can finish telling you what's happened, the next one comes in with another tale of disaster. Here the third one comes in and interrupts the second and says, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, took them away. Yes, killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." From the human viewpoint, absolute disaster. Devastation and destruction. Everything this man has just been taken from him. He's wiped out. Imagine bringing this into modern terms, what this would mean. You get the word coming down the grape line. The rumor is that your company has been bought out by a foreign concern, and they want to make it more efficient, so they're going to begin downsizing. No sooner do you get the rumor than you get a memo from the office asking you to report into a meeting, and you're handed a pink slip. You're out of work. We don't have a place for you here anymore. You go home and you find out that your bank was one of the banks that folded recently and went under and has been taken over by the federal government. Your 401k is wiped out and closed. Money that you had in the bank is gone. Everything that you had, your means of making money, your money you'd accumulated is gone. In one moment, you're wiped out. Imagine losing everything in one moment in time. And then disaster strikes and your family is taken from you as well. Can you imagine what it must have felt like to be Job, sitting on top of the world, the greatest man in the world, and from out of nowhere, disaster, unseen, takes everything that you own and possess, everything you value and hold dear. You, in a moment, you go from the top of the heap to the bottom. You're destroyed. And no reason. No reason that you can see. Nothing apparent to your eye. Remember the conversation that took place in heaven. Job wasn't privy to it. All he saw that was in a moment he went from wealth and happiness and fulfillment to being absolutely destitute and wiped out. There are few of us, I think, that could put ourselves in that place and say, I know what it means to be thoroughly and effectively wiped out in a moment of time. But Job was one. And so now watch how he handles it. Look at verse 20. Then Job arose, tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Now, I've got to be thoroughly upfront with you and confess to you that this is not me. When disaster comes in my life, one of the first things I do is cry and moan and complain, just like you. I'm nobody special. And pain hurts. And when the hurt comes, we cry out. But look at Job. When this came, he did all the things that a Hebrew would do. He rips his clothes, he shaves his head, probably throws dust and ashes on himself, falls to the ground, and worships God. Tells you something about Job's heart, where he was coming from. Because you see, if what Satan had said about Job was true, Job couldn't have worshipped. If Job was following God simply because God was good to him, then Job would have cried out in pain because the good just disappeared. If Job was following God simply because he was blessed, then now he would not feel blessed. And there would be doubt about God and insecurity and questions. And I have to confess to you, that's exactly who I am. When I hurt, I cry. My coming to Christ was kind of interesting because it came in the midst of great turmoil in my life. It was that turmoil that drew me to God. But when God came into my life, it was like the clouds parted and the sun came out. It was glorious. And almost instantly, the battle ramped up and the enemy said, oh, well, you come to God. Well, we'll see how you like coming to God. And he threw everything he had at me. And instantly, the clouds covered the sun again. My early Christian days were just filled with darkness. And I remember going through some of those things, and I remember at one particularly dark point crying out to God and saying, God, if this is the way you treat your servants, it would almost be better not to follow you because at least the enemy takes care of the people who serve him. I actually said that to God. I was in such pain and such darkness at one point that I came to God and I charged him with wrong. I said, it would almost be better not to follow you if this is what we get for it. Job didn't do that. Job fell on his face and worshiped. That's because he was enjoying the things that God brought into his life, but more than that, he enjoyed God. Job followed God because he loved God. And when the things, when the wealth, when even the family was taken away, he still had this. He still had his God. And that's why Job could worship. Some people today, I think, join churches, attend services, call themselves Christian for the wrong reason. They think that if you get on board with God, it's kind of the beginning of the gravy train because, you know, well, certain pastors will tell you, you worship God, you follow Him, and all your problems are over. You know, God wants to bless you, and of course He does. But God also wants to grow you and challenge you. And so for those who follow God because they think that's the gravy train, boy, when the hurt comes, that can really shake your faith. But if you're following God because you love God, then even if you were destroyed in a moment, you could still fall on your face and worship because now He's all you have left. And I think sometimes that's why God will allow those good things to be taken away to remind us of what really is good in our lives and what really is the focus in our life. To remind us of how greatly we need him. You ever notice that you feel like you need God more when times are bad than you do when times are good? When times are good, we feel like it's all okay, right? God, I kind of got this Christianity thing figured out. The Bible reading, the praying, the trusting, all that. Look how I'm blessed. But what happens when the hard times hit? Suddenly it's crying out to God and it's looking to God. Suddenly it's where we should be all along. Realizing that good times or bad times, our connection to eternity is through God. The things around us here are temporary. They're not permanent. The things of heaven are permanent. And we need to be connected to God through our prayer life. We need to be after God for God's sake, not for our sake. And so Job falls on his face and he worships. And he says, I came into this world without anything. I'll leave this world without anything. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Job passed the test. And that must have bugged Satan, don't you think? Because he brought the charge and God said, here's your walking paper, Satan. Satan stuffed them in his back pocket and said, oh boy, I'm going to get to work now. And he goes down and he messes with this guy's life tremendously. And this guy worships God. So the scene shifts back to heaven in chapter 2. And we see round 2 between God and Satan here. Verse 1, again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, cruising the world, man, been hanging out down there. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered, have you circled round, have you assessed, have you militarily measured my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright. That's God's estimation of Job, blameless and upright. One who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. So Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all a man has he'll give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job. And the heavenly viewpoint once again shows us this, that the things that come into our lives with the prior approval of God. God will not allow a thing to come in that will destroy you. Even when Satan says, you know, skin for skin, man. Job let his children die, but he had his own life, so sure he worships you. You touch him himself, and you watch and see how this man worships you. But still, God wouldn't let Satan destroy him. You can touch the man, you can touch all he has, but spare his life. And so once again, this reminder that when pain and suffering come into our lives, they come into us with God's knowledge, consent, and approval. Now, if it's Satan's purpose to destroy us, God must have another purpose for this pain altogether. And again, I don't have solid answers for you, other than to say that often the pain draws us closer to God. And sometimes we come to a point where we feel there's nothing but God left, and that is exactly where you should feel that you are every day of your life. Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Things come, things go. Money talks. What does it say? See ya. At least that's the way my wallet talks. But the one thing that will never depart from you, never leave you, never fail you, never let you down is Jesus Christ, God Himself. And that needs to be the focus of our lives. So Satan departs, walking papers in his back pocket. And he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. It's hard to imagine how Job must have felt. Few of us have ever experienced this kind of disaster. But in the midst of the news that his wealth is entirely gone, his servants, his household has been wiped out, alongside the news that his family has been destroyed, it's just Job and his wife now. Now Satan touches him, painful boils from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. You can't stand, you can't sit, you can't lay. There's not a part of your body that doesn't hurt. Whatever the disease was, the Bible isn't real clear, we don't know. But it involved, if you've ever had a boil or a bee sting or something where there's a swelling and a hard, painful knot, Job was covered head to foot, face, hands, toes, everything. And he would sit there and he would take a broken piece of a pot and just scrape the boils and the ooze and the crust off his body and just sit in the dust. How much can a man be reduced? His wife sees him, says, "Job, you're a nut worshiping God. Are you kidding me? Why don't you just do the natural thing? Curse God and just fall over and die." And he says, "God gives us good and we accept it. Then God takes the good away and something else comes. Now suddenly we're wiser than God. We shouldn't accept that. Suddenly God has stopped being God, even though I don't understand. No way. Can't curse him. I'll just keep worshiping my God." And in all this, Job did not sin. So once again, he passes the test far more capably than I ever have. Now, news of what's happened to Job gets around. It takes time, but the word gets out. And this Eastern world hears about this great man, this king, this priest, who has fallen on such hard times. And some of Job's friends begin to come. Now, these are Job's three comforters. We're going to spend 3 weeks looking at their discussions with Job, back and forth, talking about why he's suffering. And these guys get kind of a bad rap. Even God says, "You guys got it all wrong. The things you said to Job, none of them were right." But let's give him credit. Let's not rap him too bad, because when these guys heard, they traveled a great distance to come and be with Job. And watch how they behave when they see him. Verse 11 here. "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great." These three friends of Job's come from afar, and when they come, they don't even recognize the man. This once wealthy, prominent, happy figure has been reduced to a pitiful figure sitting on the ground, covered in dust, scraping his disease off his body. And when they see him, look at their hearts. They cry out and they mourn, they rip their robes. And then they sit down and they spend 7 days with him. They don't even say a word. They simply mourn with him for 7 days. I give these guys credit. They came and they sat down and they just mourned with him. This part, I know what it feels like. During those early days of my walk with God, I'd gone down to a school of ministry down in Albuquerque. I felt that God was calling me into the ministry. I didn't understand what was happening. My life had fallen apart. My family had been taken from me. My career had ended. I'd pretty much been wiped out almost in a day. So I can kind of relate to what Job felt like. There is a pain that comes and that goes. I'm a little more than 2 weeks out from surgery, and yesterday, praise God, was my first day without pain. Some pains come, and then they go. And then you feel pretty good again. But there are pains that come, and they simply kind of move in, and they live with you. They're long-term pains. The kind of pain you get when you're abandoned by friends. Kind of pain that comes when you're betrayed by someone you thought was a friend. And in those early days of walking with God, I was experiencing divorce and custody hearings and everything that you could imagine. My heart was destroyed. Now, when that happens, you still get up every day, don't you? You still brush your teeth, put on your clothes, shave, put on the makeup. You still go to work, and you still try to have some kind of composure in front of the world. And I did the same thing many of you have done. But there was a day sitting in class down there at the School of Ministry when we had a worship leader who'd come from Hawaii to share with us. And as we were sharing, I just began to break down in class. I don't remember if it was something that was said or just something that had risen up in my heart and my mind, but I just began to break down and just weep at my desk. And one by one, every member of the School of Ministry just got up and came around me and just put their hands on me. I didn't say a word. Just stood around me as I just disintegrated and just fell into tears and weeping. It must have gone on for 10 or 15 minutes. Just absolutely just completely falling apart. No one said a word. And the ministry leader who was leading the class that day just said, "This man has the spirit of Job upon him." And one by one, they got up and went back to their desks, and I kind of got my composure back a little bit. But let me tell you something about pain. And I'm speaking to people who've suffered. Every one of you has. Every one of you will. Sometimes when you see someone in pain, you want to come with an answer. With all your heart, you want to meet that need. You want to meet that suffering that you see. And you want to come in. And sometimes we'll come in with nice little biblical platitudes and nice little homilies and sayings from the Bible. And we'll try to share with them. You know what one of the most effective ways to minister to someone who is in pain is? Just be there. People who are hurting are looking for answers, but they're not looking for easy answers. They have real pain. They have real hurt and real suffering going on in their lives. And if you come in with a pat little answer and it's not a fit, it's going to cause more pain. And I can tell you, and I know from some of your faces that you people know this, sometimes when you're hurting, you just want someone to be there with you. That's it. Job's friend came and they sat down next to him for one solid week and did not say a word to him. They were just there. And really, I think that's kind of an expression of God's heart to us when we're in pain. Have you noticed that when you do have suffering in your life, that you'll come to God with your questions, but you notice the answers are surprisingly slim sometimes? But what you do get is this. And I experienced this through my darkness. I know many of you have experienced it too. What you do get is the presence of God with you. And in the midst of your darkness, in the midst of your suffering, you can feel God kind of settle down next to you. You can feel that arm go around you. And you know you're not alone. And for me, that meant everything. That was the entire world to me back in those days, just to know my God was with me. I didn't get the answers I wanted. Along the way, I've picked up some understanding about pain, about how it affects people. And it's made it easier for me to deal with those things when they come up. But the one thing I know that got me through the suffering was the presence of God with me. And I think that that's what God wanted me to have every day of my life. I think maybe that's partly the reason why he allowed the pain in, was to bring me to a place that I never could have come to without the suffering. To know that God simply wanted to be with me and me with him. Now that's the first two chapters of Job. We're going to leave Job right there in the dust with his three friends. When we pick up next week, and for the next 3 weeks, we'll look at the discussions they have. Each week we'll look at one set of dialogues that these friends has with Job and his answers to them. And we'll examine some of the thinking that mankind has about pain. For right now, we're just going to leave them there. Not a lot of answers for us. But let's hopefully come up with a little understanding today about pain and suffering in human lives. Let me present you with three ideas. I want you to hold on to these ideas because they will serve you well and they will help you to go through whatever comes your way. Number one, when pain comes, more often than not, you will not know why it has come. It may not make any sense to you at all. In fact, you may be living an upright life. You may think, God, why me? I know so many people whose lives are worse than mine that should be suffering. And why is this happening to me? And there be no audible voice. There may be no answer from heaven for you. But here's the heavenly viewpoint. God has a purpose. Whether he shares it with you or not is not important at the time. Because there is a heavenly viewpoint. From the earthly viewpoint, it looks crazy. But we already know from a scene behind the scenes here in heaven that God had a purpose. There was a battle going on for a man's heart. There's a battle going on for your heart today. You have an enemy, Satan, who is devoted to your destruction. He has considered you. He has weighed you. He knows your weaknesses. Balance that with this thought. You have a God who loves you, who is devoted to your well-being and your growth. Number two. Nothing that comes to you in this life will ever, ever come to you without going past God first. Satan doesn't pull end runs on the Lord. And before anything comes into your life, before any kind of suffering becomes yours, it will have received God's prior approval. That means that there is a hedge around your life. God protects those who love him. And anything that comes into your life has been considered by God, and he knows that it won't destroy you, but he knows that you'll probably come to a place where you will need his help to meet that suffering and that pain. That, I think, is part of the purpose, is to draw us close to himself. Number three, the best comfort that you can offer someone who's suffering often comes without words. It comes just by being there for them. And when I hurt, that's what I want. I want to know people are there for me. I don't want you to feel like you have to think up an answer, because I know answers are hard to come by sometimes. But what I do want is I want to know that people are with me. Now, I went through this surgery, and I was so covered with prayer, and I bless you guys for that. I know you guys had lifted me up over and over and over again, and that's what brothers and sisters in the body of Christ do for each other. Don't ever suffer alone, because you have people who love you and will come alongside of you and pray for you, and just knowing that got me through. Sometimes the best thing you can do for someone who's hurting is just be there. You don't even have to talk. Just sit down and put an arm around them, because that's what Jesus so often does to us. And by the way, if Job looks a little out of kilter, here's a man who's upright and blameless. He hasn't really done anything to deserve punishment, and yet he gets seemingly the greatest punishment. Who does that make him very like? A lot like Jesus. There was no sin in him, and yet he suffered for us, so that he could draw us close and so that we could be with him. I think that the Apostle Paul understood these things very well. There was a man who was familiar with suffering. And when he wrote a letter to a church at Philippi, in that letter in chapter 3, in verse 7, Paul said these things. What things were gained to me? Camels and sheep and servants and family. These I've counted loss for Christ. Yet indeed I also count all things loss for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord. Paul was a man who had come to a point in his life where he said, all that I had, I'm willing to count it as loss just that I might know God. For whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them as rubbish that I may gain Christ. And be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, and the righteousness which is from God by faith, that I may know him, the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death, if by any means I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. Paul was also a man who sat on top of the heap, a great religious leader in the land of Israel. He was also a man who lost it all and traded it in. He said, I would trade everything I had simply for the knowledge of God through Jesus Christ. I'd give it all up just that I might attain the resurrection from the dead and live forever with the Father in heaven. So we have a few examples before us. We have, of course, Job himself we've looked at. Man who had it all and lost it all. We're not even through with that story. We got Paul who had it all and gave it all up that he might know Jesus. And we had Jesus who literally possessed everything in heaven and left it all to come and suffer for us. What kind of encouragement does that leave us with? Part of human life is pain. From time to time, you will hurt. But it has a purpose, even if you can't understand it. It'll never come to you in a form that you can't bear up under. It will bring you closer to God, and that's been His purpose all along. So when it comes, I want to encourage me, because I'm not good at it, and I want to encourage you, when it comes, try this next time. Worship God. In the midst of the uncertainty and the lack of understanding, in the midst of the suffering, try just worshiping God and say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord. He's given me good things. One day I will put every one of them down anyways. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Worship God, because He is your final reward, isn't He? Everything here one day you will put down. What will you have then? If you have God, you've lost not a thing. You are rich beyond measure with treasure in heaven. Not a lot of answers, but maybe a little understanding and an encouragement. Father in heaven, today we just want to thank you, God. I can look back over the things I have suffered. I can thank you for them now because I see what you've done with them. I see how you've drawn me so close to you, closer than I ever would have come if I hadn't needed to come. I can look back now and thank you. The next time the waves hit, it's probably going to be hard for me to thank you. It usually is. But please remind me of a man named Job, a man who suffered and worshipped, never charged you with wrong, and in that did not sin. I'd like to pass this test the next time it comes. And with you, I know I will. Father in heaven, we bless your name today, and we do it in Jesus. Amen.
Why don't we stand?
Satisfy my soul like you.
good Redeemer.